Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 26th of December, these are our main stories. Russian police have raided the Moscow offices of President Putin's most prominent critic, Alexei Navalny. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu faces a challenge to his leadership of the Likud party ahead of an upcoming general election. Also,
you just slightly saw when the moon was fully covering and the ring was amazing, ring of fire, and it's a very nice experience.
Across Asia, people have witnessed the rare beauty of an annular solar eclipse. Also in this podcast, we have a report from Lebanon, where there's concern that the country is on the verge of total collapse. And
we will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now, is where we draw the line.
How eco-activist Greta Thunberg has inspired a remix of a dance classic from the 90s. We begin in Moscow, where police have raided the office of the leader of Russia's main political opposition. Alexei Navalny has released video of the moment that the authorities began to cut through the door to the headquarters of his anti-corruption organization.
Video camera, you can see, заклеили.
This is just the latest in a string of raids carried out against the enemies of Vladimir Putin in recent months. Mr. Navalny himself has been targeted many times. Our Moscow correspondent Sarah Rainsford told me what we know about this latest raid.
Well, we know that there were around about 40 people in the office of the Anti-Corruption Foundation, which is run by Alexei Navalny. This morning, they were holding their morning meeting when police and security forces turned up at the door. Mr. Navalny and his team refused to open the door to let them in. As you just heard there, they started to force their way in using power tools. The sparks flying from the inside of the door as they broke their way in. They then told everyone to turn their faces to the wall. Men in masks, security forces, then confiscated equipment. And it seemed that Alexei Navalny himself had been detained initially, although we then learned from him that actually he'd just been forced out of the office, dragged out into the corridor, but he wasn't actually detained. We now know that this is in connection with a criminal case which has been opened for a refusal to delete a video from the internet, a video which has been extremely popular here in Russia over the past couple of years. It's one that focuses on allegations of corruption against the Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, and other characters here in Russia, all of whom have denied the allegations. Mr. Navalny and his team were ordered to delete the file from the internet, but they haven't done that.
Why are the security forces so concerned about Mr. Navalny?
Well, there are a number of criminal cases currently underway, not just this one about the film, but also a money laundering charge, which has been levelled against the Anti-Corruption Foundation. Lots of members of the organisation have had their bank accounts blocked. They can't access any funds at all. Mr. Navalny and his team, they insist that this is all politically motivated. He is, of course, the most vocal, most obvious critic of Vladimir Putin. He runs an extremely popular blog on YouTube, Navalny Live, which is watched by hundreds of thousands of people every week. He was due to record or to go live with another episode this evening. And actually, he and his team are saying that there's no coincidence that it was precisely a Thursday when the security forces broke in to their office to carry out this latest raid.
Sarah Rainsford, our Moscow correspondent. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing a leadership challenge in his Likud party. Votes are being cast today to decide who will lead the party into the next general election, which is just a few months away. This voter, Amit Drucker, said after two failed attempts to form a government, Likud needed a new leader.
This is an important day because there hasn't been any voting for this party for the past 5 years. There's a feeling of decay in the democracy from within the party and generally in Israel.
But voter Leon Ribinik said he wanted Mr. Netanyahu to remain leader.
I came here to vote today. I'm going to vote for the current Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. I prefer people who take actions.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Barbara Plett-Asher, told me more about why Benjamin Netanyahu is facing this challenge.
There have been two elections, and in both of them, he was not able to muster enough support to form a governing coalition. And overall, there was this threat of corruption charges hanging over him. Analysts said that's why he called the elections. He wanted to get a majority government that would vote to grant him immunity from prosecution, but he wasn't successful in that. And then in coalition talks, these pending corruption charges hampered his ability to get people on board to form a coalition government. And then towards the end of the year, he was actually indicted. So he has been struggling, and that has led to some dissent within the Likud party, although by and large it has stood behind him. You do have this crack in the United Front now with this leadership challenge.
Yeah, what do we know about his challenger, Gideon Saar?
Gideon Saar has a long record in the Likud party. He's a lawyer by training, but he's a very experienced politician and party man. He was a member of the Knesset for 13 years, which included two cabinet portfolios under Mr. Netanyahu. But he took a break from politics in 2014, apparently because of tensions between him and Mr. Netanyahu. Now he's back, and he's making the argument that it's for the good of the party that Mr. Netanyahu stepped down, or that Mr. Saar become the leader, because he says the prime minister has shown himself unable to form a government. He says Mr. Netanyahu won't be able to do so after a third election pending in March. And the danger is that the right wing would lose power and Likud would go into the opposition.
And what are the chances that Mr. Netanyahu might lose?
They're not high at all. It's expected that he will win, but he wants to have a resounding victory because he wants to quell any sort of dissent within the party. So he has actually been out campaigning very strongly, four or five events every evening, and is very much hoping, according to people who watch these things closely, to get at least two-thirds support. Anything less than that would show that his grip on the party is weakening.
How much are these corruption allegations hanging over him and causing him problems?
They are hampering him in his goals. So polls show that there's a softening of general support, although not a massive drop. Politically, the most serious element is the internal challenge, and that corruption charges have led to that. But there are also legal questions about what exactly he can do in terms of forming a government if he gets that chance.
Briefly, how soon do we get the results?
We'll get them on Friday morning.
Barbara Plett-Asher speaking from Jerusalem. Officials in the Philippines have said at least 16 people are dead after a typhoon battered the country over nearly 3 days. Typhoon Panforn brought rains, flooding and wind speeds of close to 190 kilometres an hour. Peter Goffin reports.
Typhoon Panforn made landfall on the east coast on Tuesday and from there cut a path of deadly destruction across the Philippines' central islands. Many people are still missing, and thousands in this majority Catholic country were left stranded as they traveled for Christmas. Richard Gordon, the chairman of the Philippine Red Cross, said the typhoon arrived like a thief in the night.
All of a sudden, you have tremendous winds blowing, a lot of rain in some areas that caused severe flooding, and certainly a lot of roofs collapsed. One hospital's roof was blown entirely, and even some of the Red Cross warehouses, the roofs were blown off. So this was really a very, very strong howler.
Images from the Philippines have shown boats upturned, houses torn apart by wind or crushed by fallen trees. The country is hit by an average of 20 storms and typhoons each year, but they're getting harder to predict. And, as Mr. Gordon said, there's a growing feeling that the wind and rain could strike at any time.
The unusual thing about this is that we're being hit when the typhoons are supposed to be gone. Before they never went beyond November, we've had several typhoons hitting us in December, some in January, even February. So it really is a weird thing that now we have to expect typhoons at all months of the year.
As a precaution, officials suspended boat trips between the islands before the typhoon even reached land. And only now are transport channels being reopened, allowing aid workers through, said Anna Karina Arceo, a journalist for the Philippine news network, Rappler.
We have heard from the Coast Guard. Trips are being allowed already to resume between the island provinces in the Visayas since the typhoon is already over the West Philippine Sea. So it has passed landmass and trips have already resumed there. But we're seeing now the problem lies in the isolated provinces, those in the really remote areas, since travel is hampered by the blocked roads. So rescuers and aid may be unable to get to them immediately, since the clearing operations first have to be conducted before their areas can be reached.
The typhoon may have passed, but the devastation left by Panforn may not be fully known for days to come. as rescue workers and emergency crews sift through the wreckage.
Peter Goffin. Large crowds across Asia have watched an annular solar eclipse. For those watching the spectacle, the last solar eclipse of the decade, the sun appeared like a ring of fire around the moon. Farhana Darwood reports.
Thousands of people in Asia and the Middle East made special efforts to catch the rare event. UAE residents flocked out to the remote Zayed city, more than 2 hours' drive from Dubai, in order to get the best seat to witness the annular solar eclipse. It was the only place in the country where people could watch the eclipse and see the ring of fire, where the moon covers only most of the sun, leaving the edges lit up.
First time I've seen the ring as such, which was amazing experience. Normally when the full sun is fully covered, it gets dark like early in the morning, and this you just slightly saw when the moon was fully covering, and the ring was amazing, like, yeah, ring of fire, and it's a very nice experience.
Even though I knew it's going to be a partial eclipse in Dubai, I wanted to come here only to witness this once-in-a-lifetime moment. And it looks so amazing while you see it. It's like it's completely covered.
In Saudi Arabia, astronomers, tourists and locals gathered on top of Jabal Arba in the east of the country to witness the eclipse during sunrise.
Me and my family, we live in London and we've come to Saudi Arabia especially to see this event because it's very rare. If we miss it, we have to wait for another 30 years.
I am eclipse chaser. It's my 11th eclipse, and I specifically came to Saudi Arabia to see that annular solar eclipse during sunrise.
In India, even the Prime Minister Narendra Modi posted pictures of his attempts to catch the rare sight. Cloud and fog, however, blocked the view in Delhi, but people in the southern parts of the country were able to watch the celestial spectacle. Annular eclipses happen every couple of years, but they're only visible from a certain part of the Earth each time. Tom Kurz, an astronomer from the Royal Observatory Greenwich, told the BBC this time of the year is particularly exciting for astronomers.
We are actually closer to the sun than average at this time of year, as our orbit around the sun is not quite circular. And what that means is that while the size of the moon hasn't changed very much, it's more or less its average size, the sun is a little larger. So in this case, the moon cannot completely cover the sun. So we can't see a total eclipse. We see an annulus of light around the moon.
Stargazers will have to wait another year for the next total solar eclipse. It's going to happen on the 14th of December 2020 and will be visible across parts of southern Chile, Argentina, as well as southwest Africa and Antarctica.
Farhana Darwood. Lebanon is facing its worst economic crisis in a generation. Workers have been laid off, salaries have been slashed, and people can't withdraw their money from the banks. And there are warnings that the country, already paralysed by 2 months of large-scale protests, is now on the verge of economic collapse. Our correspondent, Martin Patience, reports from the town of Arsal. You may find some of his report upsetting.
I'm at a small factory where men are cutting up massive rocks quarried out of the mountainside behind me. They're using heavy machinery for the job. This stone is used in construction right across Lebanon. And in this part of the country, there are hundreds of factories like this one. But at the moment, because of the country's economic crisis, just a handful of them are now open. One of the workers, Khalid Al-Hujairi, is chiselling the stone. He's been doing this job for almost 30 years. But he tells me this is the worst economic situation he's ever known. But do you feel lucky that you've got work?
Yes, I feel lucky to have work to do. At least I can support my family. Although what I earn is hardly enough, I may be doing better than others. Because the situation in Arsal is extremely bad. Many people are jobless, and they cannot find anyone to support them.
For one man at the factory, it was too much.
Najif Liti had no work for a month and a half. And when his 7-year-old daughter, Ranim, asked him for lunch money, he didn't have it. He hanged himself at the back of his house. I asked his wife, Tahani, who she blames for her husband's death.
I don't blame anyone. It was my husband who decided to put an end to his life. But it was poverty. It was the economic situation that pushed him into it. I urge officials to change the situation as quickly as possible so there will be no more victims in Lebanon.
Back at the factory, one of the workers comes up to me. Who hanged Najif Liti? He asks. It was us, he says. We didn't support him. This is a country that in recent years has held together against the odds. But now Lebanon's facing its worst economic crisis since its civil war. And many here fear they'll no longer be able to cope.
Martin Patience reporting there from Lebanon. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
We need to go into the communities, find out what do they know, what do they want, and of course, what don't they have.
An expert tells us how the nations of the Indian Ocean can learn lessons from the devastating tsunami that struck 15 years ago. Turkey says it will send troops to Libya as soon as next month after it received an official request from Libya's internationally recognised administration, the Government of National Accord. The GNA has been fending off a months-long offensive in eastern Libya by General Khalifa Haftar's forces, which has been supported by Russia, Egypt and the United Arab Emirates. This is what President Erdogan said about the decision.
Bir taraftan mutabakat meddini imzalamışız.
Turkey signed a maritime agreement with Libya on the one hand. On the other, we signed a military cooperation agreement with them. Hopefully, this agreement will pass from our parliament around early January, and we will accept the invitation to send troops to Libya. We're standing by the legitimate government of the country and accept their invitation. This is our difference.
I asked our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, why is Turkey doing this?
Well, basically, Turkey, I think, is trying to reinforce its position in the eastern Mediterranean. It's a country that's increasingly isolated. Tensions, obviously, with Greece and Israel for over long-standing time. Tensions with Egypt, the military regime there, remembers very well that Turkey backed the Muslim Brotherhood efforts to control the country during the Arab Spring. So Turkey sees this as a strategic venture. It insists its backing, as you heard, there, an internationally supported government in Tripoli, whereas other countries like Russia, Egypt, the UAE are backing simply what the Turks say is a warlord. The problem is that Russian support for General Haftar's forces, the Libyan National Army, has rather changed the momentum of the conflict, changed the balance of power there, which has increasingly been at a stalemate. And I think the real risk now is that if the Turks intervene, and it's not clear exactly what Turkish troops would do, would they be advisers, would they be fully fledged combat forces? But this is just going to add, another ratchet to the worsening crisis in Libya.
Yeah, briefly, as you indicated, Russia has voiced concern about this. How much will this complicate matters in Libya?
Well, it will complicate matters. At the moment, we believe a certain number of Russian mercenary forces from a supposedly private company, Wagner, have been operating there. Of course, it puts Ankara and Moscow on a collision course. They have a complex relationship, close on some areas, rather more tortuous and difficult on others. But it certainly means that diplomacy between Russia and Turkey is going to be a key factor in sorting out the terrible mess in Libya.
Jonathan Marcus, our diplomatic correspondent. In Australia, as we record this podcast, more than 70 bushfires are still raging in the state of New South Wales. In case anyone thought things were getting under control there, on the contrary, the cooler weather is about to be replaced by further heatwave conditions. Our correspondent, Phil Mercer, is in Bilpin. It's 75 kilometres northwest of Sydney, towards the Blue Mountains, and Phil has been talking to a farmer there.
He stayed with his son to join the firefighters defending his property, and he was telling us that he was confronted by flames up to 40 metres high, 40 metres high, confronting him when there was a sudden wind change. It brought those flames racing towards him, and he said he was very lucky to survive. 40% of his farm, 40% of his orchard has been destroyed, and clearly in this bushfire crisis in Australia, there's been a huge physical, emotional and financial toll. And you also have to remember that this has been a nationwide crisis. In the last few weeks and months, we've had very dangerous days for firefighters and residents in the states of Queensland and Western Australia, and there are still active fires in South Australia and the state of Victoria. So Australia is enduring this hideous, brutal summer. More heatwave conditions are expected, but the authorities say that the firefighters effort is very well organised, and Australia is well used to these sorts of conditions, maybe not on this scale, but we've had firefighters coming in from New Zealand, from Canada, from the United States, from other parts of Australia to join the firefighting effort here in New South Wales. Safe to say it's a military style operation. That emergency effort is holding the line, as it were, but in many places it is being stretched very, very thin.
Phil Mercer speaking from Bilpin in New South Wales. Still on the subject of forest fires in Chile, the authorities say that a fire that encroached on the port city of Valparaiso has now destroyed at least 200 houses. Government ministers and the city's mayor also said there was a strong indication that the blazes were started deliberately. For more, I spoke to our correspondent Jane Chambers, who's in Santiago and whose family come from the town next to Valparaiso.
Well, unfortunately, this isn't the first time. I mean, there are often fires in Chile, and often people think that they start them deliberately. I mean, there are lots of different reasons, but they definitely think this time round that these fires were started intentionally, but which is really a horrible thing to think about. You know, people at Christmas time, totally destitute and homeless with everything burnt. Another issue as well is there's a lot of kind of rubbish around, so that also doesn't help with the blaze, with the fires, you know, going through if you've got all this rubbish around the place as well.
And reports say a dozen firefighters were injured while battling the blazes. Are they the only casualties?
Yes, at the moment they're saying those are the only casualties. It's hard being a firefighter in Chile because they're actually volunteers here. And yes, we're hearing reports that they've been injured and they do it for free, their own free time. So it's hard for them.
And the police urging people with information to come forward?
Very much so, yes. They say there'll be a full investigation and urging people to come forward. But also this is just the beginning of the season. I mean, it's summertime here. There's a massive drought in Chile. And there are real worries that this is going to just be the start of fires. You know, people maybe just leaving a cigarette butt or having a picnic with a fire. So it's a real issue. So they're urging people to come forward for this one. But they're also saying for the future, just to be vigilant and to get in touch with them if they see anything. Because obviously, if a fire is small, it's a lot easier to put out than if it gets larger.
Jane Chambers speaking to me from Santiago. 15 years ago today, a powerful earthquake occurred off the coast of Indonesia's Aceh province, triggering a tsunami which killed more than 230,000 people across the region. Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, Thailand and 9 other countries were affected. Ilan Kelman, Professor of Disasters and Health at University College London, has been looking closely at tsunamis. So, what lessons can we learn from 2004?
Well, there were two primary general lessons which apply to us all and which apply well beyond tsunamis and earthquakes. And number one is that to a large extent, we actually know what these natural events are going to do. We knew that the possibility for an Indian Ocean-wide tsunami was there. We knew that people were on vulnerable coastlines and did not have the awareness and did not have the support that they needed to get the warnings and to act accordingly. So we actually need to listen to what the science is saying in order to act long before the natural event manifests and stop the disaster. And that leads to the second lesson, that actually we don't use the phrase natural disaster because there's so much that we can do, meaning disasters are not natural. And the way that we do it is by starting with the people. So we need to go into the communities, find out what do they know? What do they want? What can they offer regarding possible evacuation routes, possible responses, possible monitoring? And of course, what don't they have?
Professor Ilan Kelman of University College London. The Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg has been one of 2019's most influential figures. She beat President Trump to become Time magazine's Person of the Year. Young people on every continent have been galvanised by the 16-year-old's campaign to make world leaders and governments recognise global warming as a climate emergency. And Greta's message has had such an impact, it's been remixed with a famous dance track. Maddie Savage sent this report from Greta Thunberg's hometown of Stockholm.
All right, I'm just going online to bring up the original. I was a teenager when it came out, so brings back lots of memories. I think this is the key bit. Right Here, Right Now is a track by British DJ Fatboy Slim. It reached number 2 in the UK charts in 1999. And it's had a revival thanks to the speech that Greta Thunberg made after she sailed across the Atlantic to the UN's climate summit.
We will not let you get away with this. Right here, right now is where we draw the line. The world is waking up. And change is coming whether you like it or not. Thank you.
This is the remix of her words that went viral.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right here, right now.
The mashup was first posted online by David Scott, a DJ from Cape Town, but weeks later, Fatboy Slim himself started mixing in Greta's voice during his live sets, including here in Stockholm in November.
My name is Oscar Malm-Vickland, and I'm 26 years old. The whole reason I came here tonight is the Right Here, Right Now mix, because it's a message that is so close to my heart, and people just went crazy. People got up their phones, people started jumping.
My name is Shannon, I'm 24. I think he couldn't have picked a better timing for the sample as well. I thought it was really on point, and it made everybody feel really proud and happy to have been here tonight.
The track also went down well with Fridays for Future, the global school strike movement started by Greta Thunberg. I met up with one of the organisers, Isabel Axelsson, outside the Swedish Parliament, where the Stockholm strikes usually happen.
If we are getting our message about saving the climate into mainstream music, then we are really spreading the message outside of the environment bubble, outside of the climate bubble. She speaks with such unforgivingness in what she is saying. She is so aware of what is happening, and people pick up on that. They realise that this is something really serious.
Greta Thunberg isn't without her critics, even in Sweden. Jimmy Åkesson, the leader of the nationalist Sweden Democrats, the country's second largest party in the polls, recently described her as a girl with anxiety who believes the world will soon collapse, which he says isn't the case. But for the most part, she remains a green icon and someone who unexpectedly helped popularise 56-year-old Fatboy Slim with a new generation of teenagers.
Change is coming, whether you like it or not. Thank you.
Greta Thunberg there, ending that report by Maddie Savage. And over the next week, the Global News podcast will feature other pieces of music which have inspired people over the past year. And before we go, here's some news about another BBC World Service podcast that I think you'll enjoy.
Hello, this is Kevin Fong from 13 Minutes to the Moon, and I've got a present for you. Our award-winning podcast telling the epic story of the Apollo 11 moon landing was beautifully accompanied by the music of Oscar-winning composer Hans Zimmer. In a special extra episode, Hans will be telling us how he wrote the theme.
All we're doing with the music is we're opening the door a little crack and say, okay, now let your imagination run free.
And you can even download the track for free. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon from the BBC World Service. Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't heard the series yet, you'll find it all there.
And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson, and until next time, goodbye.
Ready for a game changer? It'll only take a minute. Seriously. This one is for the go-getters and the side hustlers out there. Expressi by Essie is the new quick dry on the fly nail polish that dries in about a minute. One step color and shine, no base or top coat needed. Their patented angled brush makes application easy with both hands, even your non-dominant hand. With 40 unconventional shades, there's a color for every mood. Learn more about Expressi at Essie.com. It's time to seize the minute. Wait for nothing.